Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the December 19, 2019 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. Let's start with establishing a quorum, starting with Maria.
Aye.
Villegas, present.
Hey, Rainey here.
Tatayan here. And Council Member Ken Weinberg will be arriving a little late. So we do have a quorum. Mike Gatto is joining us by phone. Mike?
Yes, present.
Thank you. Okay, now we have a quorum. On to adoption of the November 21, 2019 meeting summary. We have an amended summary. Mm-hmm. Here is Ken.
You need a motion?
Yes. So moved. Moved by Councilmember Moranian.
Second.
Second by Councilmember Fiorini. How are you? The meeting summary is adopted. Oh, I'm sorry. Vote.
Moranian, aye.
The Villegas, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Weinberg, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Gatto, aye. Great. Now the meeting is summary is adopted. On to the chair's report, I want to share with you that I had the opportunity to participate in a panel at the Association of California Water Agencies conference on December 4. The panel was devoted to building blocks for success in the Delta, and I joined Vice Chair Didi D'Adamo of the State Water Resources Control Board, Director of DWR Carlin Namath, and our moderator was Ellen Hannick of PPIC. It was a really great opportunity to talk about our science and our science and funding governance initiative. And I was also asked about the relevance of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act to the Delta. And there was a fair amount of back and forth on the WRP1 policy, reduced reliance, regional self-reliance. And so it was a great opportunity. Also on December 5, I attended a PPIC luncheon devoted to their report. The title of the report is A Path Forward for California's Freshwater Ecosystems, and I highly recommend that you view the video recording of that gathering. The Delta Plan was highlighted as an example of an ecosystem-based management plan, so that was great to hear during that gathering. They also had an excellent panel of some folks who were practicing ecosystem-based restoration management. And lastly, just yesterday, I attended a roundtable that Secretary Crowfoot hosted. He has launched an initiative called Cutting the Green Tape. And the point of this initiative is to increase permitting and funding efficiencies, something that the council and DPIC has already been exploring. So Jessica Law and I attended the roundtable discussion, and what they're shooting for out of that process is to develop a white paper on actions focused on cutting the green tape. Namely, improving the efficiencies in permitting and funding. The initial roundtable was a mix of high-level folks from NGO conservation organizations, resource conservation districts, agencies, of course, the Water Board, Karen Ross from Department of Food and Ag. And, yeah, I think it was mostly agencies and NGOs and practitioners who have been suffering through permitting barriers. So the goal of that effort is to have recommendations by the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which is Earth Day April 22? Anyway, by the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, they hope to have a product. And that's it for the chair's report, unless there are questions. And Randy, go ahead.
I attended the second of Secretary Crowfoot's Delta Roundtables. He's purposed to conduct these quarterly. The Monday meeting this week was held in Stockton. The agenda included an update from the Natural Resources Agency on conveyance on the resiliency portfolio. There was discussion about the federal biops and the long-term operations EIR from the State Water Project and an update on the voluntary agreement. That took up about half of the time, and the bulk and the remainder of the time was spent discussing flood control levees and channel capacity. And the Secretary sought input from those who were around the table. Clearly, a lot of Delta interests were there, and I would share with you that there were some characterizations of the role of the Stewardship Council that were inaccurate. There was an agreement to roll this topic over to the next quarterly meeting that is targeted for March, and it would be my recommendation, and it has been my recommendation to our chair, that we attempt to provide or be given an opportunity for the Stewardship Council to be a part of the next presentation at the Secretary's Roundtable. So that was a good meeting. Oscar was there. He made sure I didn't say anything inappropriate.
Turned off his
Thank
mic
you.
Okay, thank you. Any comments from the public? On this item, no comments. Great. Well, in that case, we will move on to Agenda Item 7, Executive Officer's Report.
Good afternoon. Thank you. To start, I'm pleased to announce that late last month, we hit a major milestone with regard to our draft ecosystem amendment. A public review draft of the amendment to the Delta Plan's Ecosystem Restoration Chapter, or Chapter 4, including its recommendations and its regulatory policies, was released for a 60-day public comment period on November 22nd. The draft amendment was developed through council member discussion, direction, and feedback, stakeholder engagement, and based upon our learning from robust scientific synthesis, including forecasted climate impacts. The draft amendment describes the urgency for accelerated restoration, diverse, highly functioning ecosystem as opposed to a species-specific management, as was the focus, it sounds like, of the PPIC event and also some of the discussions around the Secretary's Green Tape Initiative. It reiterates that project success and expediency is contingent upon early communication and even partnership with neighbors and locals. And it describes the importance of right place, right project restoration planning for resiliency and to ensure broad public benefits from projects. In a report released earlier this month, as the chair mentioned, the PPIC really highlighted some of these same strategies or similar strategies and recognized that both the Reform Act and the Delta Plan are exemplary models of this approach. The text of the amendment, along with background information and CEQA project description, can be found on the council's website. So anyone wishing to provide comments on the preliminary public review draft can do so by emailing the council, calling the council, or writing the council. And the email address that we specifically have set up for public comment on the ecosystem amendment draft is ecosystemamendment@deltacouncil.ca.gov. And we are encouraging comments be submitted before 5 p.m. on January 21st, 2020. But I can't express my appreciation enough for the expert staff that have really pulled this draft together. I want to mention them by name. That would be Ron Melser, Avery Livingood, Vera Bezdacek, Jeff Henderson, and Jessica Law, and there are more. Great job hitting this important milestone. I also want to appreciate the additional direction that we've received from Chair Tatayan, Vice Chair Fiorini, and Councilmember Ken Weinberg as we have sent out iterations of this draft and started to fine-tune what will be the Council's new, revised, and hopefully improved policies on ecosystem restoration in the Delta. Staff are continuing to offer briefings to anyone who is interested on the topic. We've got several lined up already for early January for those who have approached us with interest. And we look forward to the dialogue that this draft creates as we move into 2020. On December 2nd, the Council sent a letter to the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority regarding the final EIS-EIR for their long-term water transfers project. Council representatives, including Chair Tatayan, also met with Water Authority representatives regarding this project in November, and details are included in the letter in your packet. On December 17th, we also sent a letter to the City of Lathrop regarding the notice of preparation of an EIR for the Lathrop Consolidated Treatment Facility Surface Water Discharge Project, and thanks to Vice Chair Fiorini for bringing this project to our attention. The project would repurpose approximately 1.1 miles of existing recycled water pipeline or construct approximately 1.7 miles of new effluent pipeline within city right-of-way and install a new river outfall to discharge excess treated wastewater from the facility to the San Joaquin River. And details are included in our letter. The public review period for the Central Valley Flood Protection Board's certification of consistency for the American River Watershed Common Features Project closed on November 25th with no appeals filed. And on November 29th, the Contra Costa County Flood Control District submitted a certification of consistency for the Lower Marsh Creek Stream Corridor Restoration Program. The district found that the proposed project is consistent with the Delta Plan. Specifically, they find that the proposed project is consistent with 6 Delta Plan policies, while the remaining 11 are not applicable to their project. The program is a joint resolution and flood joint restoration and flood risk reduction program between the district and the nonprofit American Rivers for the Lower Marsh Creek area in Contra Costa County. There are many more details included in their certification, which is posted on our website. The public review and appeal period for the project is open from November 29th through Monday, December 30th, 2019. As always, we've included in your board packet an outreach highlights report and also an active projects list, which includes details of the various either covered actions or potential covered actions or projects of interest that the council staff is tracking on a weekly basis. Later on the agenda today, the Department of Water Resources had approached us to offer an update on planning and schedule for the next iteration of Delta Water conveyance infrastructure. And additionally, we're pleased to bring to you an end-of-year update on the Delta Plan's performance measures, which we now have a full suite of performance measures available on an online dashboard. And so I'm looking forward to that presentation and especially how that project develops over the course of the next few years so that we have more quantitative data to assess both the influence and efficacy of the Delta Plan and its implementation and where we can continue to improve the Delta Plan overall. And with that, I conclude my executive officer's report.
Great. Thank you, Jessica. Are there any public comments? Any questions from council members? All right, then we'll move on to agenda item 8, lead scientist report, Dr. John Calloway.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan. We have a guest here from the San Francisco Estuary Project, Caitlin Sweeney, and so I think I'll start with the item that's in the report. Caitlin, if you want to come and join us, there should be a name tag there for you. Caitlin is the director of the San Francisco Estuary Project, and I've already mentioned to you previously, the State of the Estuary report that came out at the State of the Estuary conference in October. Caitlin was instrumental in putting together both the conference and the report, and so she's going to give us an overview of some of the findings from the report. A few things to highlight in terms of relevance for the Stewardship Council It is the State of the Estuary Report that covers both the Bay and the Delta, and I think especially with this report, and over the last few years, there's been a strong effort to integrate the findings from both the Bay and the Delta into the State of the Estuary Report. And later today, you'll be hearing about performance measures. It's definitely directly relevant to the performance measures issues, and we're thinking about how we can coordinate the performance measures into the indicators that are a part of the State of the Estuary Report. So I will turn it over to Caitlin to give you an overview. So thank you, Caitlin, for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to be here today to talk about the State of the Estuary Report. I do just want to take just a few minutes just to give a background on the Estuary Partnership for anybody who isn't fully up to speed. So we are part of the National Estuary Program, one of 28 estuaries of national significance under the U.S. EPA's Clean Water Act. So essentially, our job is to leverage federal, state, and local resources to advance projects and programs that increase the health and resiliency of the entire San Francisco Bay Delta estuary. So this map actually shows you the planning areas. John said we cover not only the bay, but the delta and all of the watersheds that drain into those areas. We are a federal, state, and local partnership. So we're, again, a national program under US EPA. Our fiscal and administrative home has been the Association of Bay Area Governments for many years. Recently, the Association of Bay Area Governments merged staff with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. So now we are actually under ABAG / MTC and are working very collaboratively with our partners there. And then we are also guided by a 38-member implementation committee, which includes representatives from local, state, and federal agencies, businesses, environmental organizations, and includes representation from the Delta Stewardship Council. So with that in mind, one of the responsibilities of the partnership is to track and report out on the health of the estuary. So the State of the Bay and the State of the Estuary reports really are the most comprehensive health reports that we have completed for the entire estuary. The reports rely on best available science and recent data to assess the status and the trends of various parts of the ecosystem. And then this October, we were very pleased to release the 2019 update to the State of the Estuary Report, which John mentioned. The State of the Estuary Report is completed in partnership with the Delta Stewardship Council as a key funder and a collaborating partner and participant on the steering committee for the report. I also want to mention that the San Francisco Estuary Institute, our science nonprofit partner, took the lead role as lead scientist and herding of science cats, which we're very grateful for. And I think joining us by phone is Letitia Grenier, and she is the director of SFEI's Resilient Landscapes Program, and she was the lead scientist on this report. So she's here listening in and can jump in with any of the more difficult science questions should any arise that I'm not able to cover. So thank you, Letitia. I know she's on mute. So with this 2019 update, there she is. With this 2019 update, we really focused on an overall theme of resilience and focusing in on this idea that the health of the estuary and the health of the people that live near it and recreate around it and depend upon it are, of course, linked. And that we also need a much greater focus on landscape resilience so that we can determine how well the Bay and Delta are going to be equipped to respond to future change. So we've been thinking about it as sort of highlighting this nexus between social resilience and ecological resilience as we look towards the future. So the San Francisco Estuary, no surprise to you, is a very large and diverse system. And the complexity and scale of the system means that it can really, in some cases, take years to detect change. In our 2015 State of the Estuary Report, reported out on 32 indicators of change. For this update, we zeroed in on updating just 5 of those indicators. So we took 5 from the 2015 report, and we focused on 5 indicators that were estuary-wide so that we could really talk about how the entire estuary was doing as a system. And we focused in on those indicators where those data that we had available could detect some change, and frankly, where we could tell a story. We could pick and choose and really tell a story about the entire estuary. So this is the overall scorecard. I'm going to go into depth a little bit, but I want to make sure that you're following along with what this means. So the indicators that we updated are on the left. And then we have a scorecard which reports out on the status, which is the color, good, fair, poor, and then the trend. Where is the condition of that indicator heading? Improving, no change, declining, or in some cases mixed. Where the status and trend are the same for the Bay and the Delta, you'll just see one box, but in most cases, you know, they're a little bit different for the Bay or the Delta, so you'll see that change reflected. So in terms of results and how we're doing, I want to start off with some of the positive stories, and one is about tidal marsh. So tidal marsh restoration is really proceeding at a brisk pace in the Bay and very much gaining traction, as you know, in the Delta. And I think this really reflects an understanding of our entire region as to the urgency of our need to restore our tidal marsh ecosystems and restore them at a pace and scale that will benefit us as we are facing impacts from sea level rise. So although the status of the Bay and Delta with regard to acreage isn't exactly where we need it to be, where we'd like to see it, the trend is very much improving for both, with a real shift in the trend from 5 years ago happening in the Delta. So that's a real positive story. The other real positive story is with regard to urban water use and water conservation. So our major urban areas in both the Bay and the Delta met and exceeded mandated water conservation measures during the drought years. And then what we're seeing is that post-drought, even when those conservation measures are no longer mandated, we're still seeing that same behavior change, and we're still using much less water than we were prior. So what this shows, I think, is really our ability, again, as a community to change our behavior in response to a crisis and then really keep that behavioral change even post-crisis.
Are you moving from this slide?
Yeah, oh, I'm happy to go back.
Before you move,
absolutely.
Yeah, I know you gave us the good news, but on the freshwater flow.
Oh, I'll get there.
Oh, you are.
Here we go. On the other hand.
Yes, good. Thank
on
you.
The other hand. yes, freshwater flow. Freshwater flowing into our estuary from rivers and streams, as you know, has been highly altered, and this is a similar story that we've been seeing in past years. We know that freshwater flows are critical for ecosystem processes and that the estuary is still experiencing what we term to be a chronic drought relative to what we might see if flows were completely unimpaired into our system. So the status of this indicator is poor and the trend is still declining throughout the estuary. And I think we have a similar story to tell with regard to beneficial floods, this idea that water flowing across floodplains across the estuary and into the Delta and Bay are also important drivers of ecological processes. And that beneficial floods continue to be well below the frequency and the magnitude and the duration that we need to increase and restore ecosystem health. So in other words, we still need to give rivers more room to roam and move, and we need to think about releasing water from dams at strategic points. This picture is from Consumnis, which is a real positive story there, but wanted to show it illustrates the benefits of beneficial flooding. Yes.
Caitlin, the term beneficial floods brings to mind occasional natural events. And yet, what we're trying to achieve is a more managed system, managed floodplain inundation. Do you think that's really the best title for what I think you're trying to promote?
It is a difficult concept to get across with any title, I will grant you that. It always requires explaining. So I think in some cases we are talking about management, and in other cases we're talking about taking advantage of those natural opportunities that we see with restoring our floodplains and allowing for that. But yes, if you come up with a better term, we will change it in the future.
Well, I would suggest something along the lines of floodplain inundation.
Mm-hmm.
That would suggest a little more of a managed approach, because floods, it just brings the connotation of a negative, and we're trying to promote a positive.
I appreciate that. I think we had some of the same discussions, and we chose to keep the same wording we had in 2015, but that doesn't mean we can't change it in the future. I like that suggestion. Thank you. So fish. The fish story is more complex, of course. In the upper estuary, fish communities are in poor condition in most of the subregions that we examined, with mixed trends. And the state of the communities, I think, really reflects the long-term decline that we've been witnessing, as well as the more short-term adverse conditions from recent drought and related actions. The exception, interestingly, to the overall trend in the upper estuary is in Susu Marsh, where the relative percent of native fish have showed an improvement over the past 5 years. And then in the lower estuary, while the overall status is good, the long-term trend analysis actually shows that fish communities are declining. And what is interesting about that is that this is based on a 38-year data set. So it's taken us 38 years to be able to detect that long-term trend, showing, again, sort of the importance of being able to collect and track these trends over a long period of time. Oh, back one, sorry. So the report also discusses three what we're calling emerging indicators of estuary health. So this idea that we're looking to the future and how we might measure resilience and trying to discover new ways of measuring resilience and capturing it in a report like this. So this report we chose and worked out three new measures of landscape and community resilience, three new emerging indicators, which I'll walk through quickly. So the first one is subsided lands. So this idea that we can evaluate the resilience of the estuary shores through the lens of subsidence, that elevation related to sea level is this sort of basic currency that we want to track over time. We all know that significant portions of previously tidal areas of the bay and delta have been diked off and disconnected from tidal action to accommodate various uses, development, and agriculture. And across the estuary, what we found is there are about 400,000 acres of land at intertidal or subtidal elevations that are now disconnected from the tides, which is interesting because that is actually a larger area than the acreage that is connected to the tides or influenced by tides on an everyday basis. And about three quarters, no surprise to you, of those lowlands are located in the delta region. And, of course, the low elevation of these areas places them at increased risk of flooding as sea level rises and rains become more intense. And as sea levels rise and lands continue to subside, flooding from creeks and groundwater becomes more prevalent, greater intervention will clearly be needed to maintain and protect land uses behind these areas, behind these levees. And also, of course, there are many areas behind these levees that offer us great opportunities to restore land to tidal action, and we're seeing that throughout the estuary as well. So future iterations of this analysis will help us gauge how well wetland restoration and other interventions like sediment augmentation can change elevations in the region and enhance our resilience. So the next emerging indicator we dug into is another way to measure shore resilience. So again, levees and seawalls have hardened much of the estuary's once more soft and absorbent shores. And these levees and seawalls not only don't provide good habitat for native species, but also in many cases aren't designed to accommodate projected future flooding. So the potential for the estuary shore to be resilient to climate change and continue to provide benefits to people is very tied to how much of the shore zone is nature-based or has some sort of natural element to it. Mm-hmm. So for this report, we were actually able to evaluate shore resilience based on mapping shore type all around the estuary. And we found that in the bay, more than half of the shore supports some sort of natural or managed wetland that can help facilitate resilience. But in the delta, only 13% of the shore supports these ecosystems. So over time, again, this indicator could track management actions to protect communities and land uses using adaptation strategies that include nature-based adaptation. And as this indicator is refined in future iterations, it's also going to be important to keep in mind, in this case in particular, the differences between the bay and the delta. In the bay, much of the shore is located on the edge and includes, an area for transition to upland areas, whereas in the delta, on the other hand, much of the shore is along levee channels bordering subsided lands. So different types of nature-based strategies will be more appropriate and more feasible, more successful in different areas of the estuary. whereas in the Bay we might focus on beach restoration or restoring, you know, subtidal oyster reefs. In the Delta we might focus more on wetland restoration to halt subsidence and regain elevation.
Just ask a question on that comparison. On the Bay, does there tend to be very minimal land use conflicts, or has that all been sorted out in the past? I mean, in seems like the, you know, the difference in land use in the Delta and the difference in land use in the Bay on the edges seems to be not comparable.
Letitia may want to jump in. I do think at the, you know, I know more about the Bay, so I'm coming at it from that perspective, but I do think we have a fairly good understanding in the Bay of where these opportunities are for nature-based solutions, including where we might have willing collaborations with adjacent land uses and landowners. But not to say that there aren't areas of conflict where we really might need to collaborate to find some sort of solution of mutual benefit. But I think we're also finding an understanding of the benefits of nature-based solutions, regardless of the adjacent land use, that we can really provide increased resiliency along with these co-benefits, with habitat, with recreational opportunities, with better aesthetics. And these are strategies that are much cheaper to maintain over time than a levee or a seawall. Clearly, there are areas where levee or seawall are your only option. You know, that's something also we need to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it just seems like there's more opportunities on the Bay, maybe more easily implemented.
And you may have something to say.
I think for in both cases, it's the public lands where there's the immediate mm-hmm. opportunity. So it's, you know, where the conservancy on lands or in the wildlife refuge in the South Bay, the salt ponds that were privately owned but are now large parts of them are publicly owned. So I think similarly in the Delta, those are the immediate opportunities, but mm-hmm. then willing sellers are the next obvious step, you know.
So the last emerging indicator that's in the report is about urban green space. We were really interested in exploring ways to track community resiliency and equity. So knowing that access to green space and nature is related to human health benefits, whether it's, you know, improving air quality, reducing local temperatures, including increasing mental well-being, providing opportunities for exercise and recreation. So the report analyzes park and population distributions together to determine how equitably people benefit from parks. So most urban areas around the estuary exceed the national average in terms of park access. That's the good news story here. We do a pretty good job in increasing and providing green space to our residents. However, the amount of accessible land varies, and in disadvantaged communities, parks tend to be smaller with more potential users nearby than in other areas. So an indicator like this could allow us to track changes in public access to green space over time with this lens of equity. And finally, the report also has sort of a narrative through line to it, this idea that we really wanted to hear voices from the people themselves from the estuary. So voices from those that recreate in and around the estuary, voices from those landowners who choose to restore their creeks and floodplains or improve water quality in addition to their other land uses, and those who are working really hard to weave environmental justice and racial equity into environmental management. We know that many of the same drivers that put the health and the function of the estuary at risk have also placed certain communities at risk, and that the impacts of impaired estuarine health are not felt equally. And so whether we're talking about rising seas, quality of drinking water, health of the fish that people eat, or as we discussed earlier, proximity to open space. So as communities really lead the way in this arena and government agencies such as mine build our skills to partner and collaborate, I do see that solutions are emerging that work to address historical patterns of injustice. And we know, essentially, that we can't restore the ecological health without restoring our social fabric and addressing these history of past injustices. So the State of the Estuary Report really drives regional actions taken by the partnership and the council and our partners to increase the health and resilience of the estuary. So in thinking about sort of the big take-home messages of the report, We need to continue to invest in restoration. We're doing a great job, but probably need to continue to do that and increase the pace and scale of our restoration efforts. We see that behavior can change and that is a sustainable change, and continuing to find ways to change behaviors and support behavior change. Clearly, and continue focused on restoring the freshwater flows to our system, expanding and building resilient shorelines, looking for opportunities, and making room to weave social equity more strongly into our efforts to improve the health of the environment, and, of course, continuing to monitor and reporting out on these changes over time. We know that resilience is not rebuilt or regained overnight, and those of us engaged in reporting on it, analyzing it, responding to these challenges really need to, as we say, stick it up and step it up. So the full report, I believe you have in your packet. It's also available online should you want to. I want to again thank the Delta Stewardship Council for your support of this report. We certainly couldn't have done it without you, and it's been a great partnership and really, again, thinking about our opportunities to look at the estuary as an entire system. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I know Letitia is online as well. Thank you.
Council members, any questions? Oscar?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I always look at these kinds of reports as sort of what's the takeaway, and then what are some, you know, reasonable, actionable items, so it doesn't just get presented and then find itself on a shelf somewhere. And so I always try to ask, so what can we do? Or assuming that you're presenting it to a range of interested parties, are there distillable aspects of the report that can be embedded in practices or ideas or principles that we use here working at the Stewardship Council? And I wonder maybe if staff or whomever might be able to help, assuming that the partnership is going to continue to live and be vibrant and mutually beneficial, right? Yeah, some knock on some wood. And I know you only touched upon a handful of the indicators, and there are many more. It would seem that a lot of what is, you know, predicated in the Delta is based upon freshwater flows, right? I think from that key indicator, there's a series of ones that are affected. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there are things that we should be thinking about, or that our staff is looking at, or that there are ways in which we can provide consideration to what is clearly one of the leading indicators identified in the report. So.
Well, I'd say the key thing we've been trying to think about is functional flows, and how can we most effectively use the water that is available. I think that the presentation at PPIC really highlighted a lot of those issues as well. And I think the voluntary agreements will be where there's hopefully some opportunities to improve the way that we are managing flows and using flows for ecosystem benefits, and then connecting that to restoration. So it's not just flows alone, it's a combination of flows and restoration, and linking, you know, the beneficial floods and floodplain inundation. To me, that's where it's really critical. The paper that I chose to talk about is all about those issues. So I think in terms of actionable issues, I would say, as was highlighted, putting more effort and more thought into how we jumpstart restoration, which I think the ecosystem amendment really is pushing hard on that, yeah. Connecting that to flows. And then the last thing I would say is connecting it to social issues that I think is really a key part of what the report is all about. And in that regard, I was going to mention at the end of my report, but I'll mention now, just probably today or tomorrow, the draft report of the Social Science Task Force will come out, which has really been our biggest effort to get traction in that area and to raise the awareness of the importance of social issues and to get some more research moving in that regard. Those would be my three key issues.
Thank you. Could I add maybe on to that a little bit, John?
Letitia. Yes, Letitia, please.
Thanks. I agree with everything John said. And the one thing I would add is that from the Delta perspective, this report can seem very negative, but I just want to remind everybody that when we see examples of change happening in the Delta, the ecosystem responds. So it's my sense of it is it's not an ecosystem that's so far gone that our actions can't achieve results just as they're achieving them in the Bay. When we've seen some example kind of pilot attempts to create floodplain inundation, and the way that the yellow bypass is being managed is changing. And, you know, those are really, really effective management actions. And as John said, I think the thing that needs to be done is just increasing the pace of making those kinds of things happen. So I don't think it's, there are certainly economic and political challenges, but on the ecological side, there are actions that are very doable, you know, hopefully in the next decade or two, that could be very effective. And I just want everyone to remember that, because this can look very negative from the Delta side. But as John said, I think it's very baked into the direction you're going with the Delta plan and the ecosystem amendment.
Great. Thank you, Letitia. Are there any other questions? Any public comment?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I just wanted to comment briefly on, it was an excellent overview, and I was listening on my phone. I had trouble pulling it up on my screen at work, so I walked over. But so I'm not sure what's going on with the feed. Hopefully others are able to log in. But I wanted to comment on this idea of the functional flows. I mean, I would really encourage, and I heard the lead scientist point to the voluntary agreements as a potential pathway for that. And I guess I don't really know what the council's plan for engagement in the voluntary agreement process is, whether that would be a covered action or whether there would be some other advisory role that this entity might play eventually. But I would really encourage lead scientists and staff here to really take a substantive look at what is being proposed in the voluntary agreements. What I have just begun, you know, over the course of this year, attending the plenary meetings and going to the Delta BET meetings, which is about the restoration planned in the Delta. And from my, you know, limited experience with those agreements, I would say it's very underwhelming what is being proposed in terms of flow. And in particular, there are no flows being proposed for release from the parties in the summer and fall months. So, and also in many critical and critically dry years, very little flows. So, you know, the Water Board did commence a process. They did have phase one. They did adopt flows for San Joaquin. They are poised to adopt flows for Sacramento. For the Delta and for our need for freshwater flows through the Delta, the state board process is probably more likely to yield results that would benefit flows. Now, I know you will need to go through your own process, but I would just urge you not to assume that the voluntary agreement is the answer to flows and to take a hard look at what is actually being proposed to the extent you can. There is modeling that has just come out in the last month, and you guys probably have staff that would be poised to examine that, and I know there'll be some additional layers to that coming to fruition in the next, hopefully in January, that may bear more upon the water quality aspects within the Delta with which you'd be concerned. So I just take it, you know, don't assume anything about the VA. Take a hard look at it and then, you know, make your judgments. Thanks.
John, can you remind us what the biological goals science panel that you brought together about a year ago to advise the voluntary agreement process did?
Yeah, so we had an outside panel that looked at the goals related to the board's, to the update to the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan, specific, focusing on the San Joaquin and the Sacramento, but as well as the Delta. And they looked at connecting flows to biological effects for salmonids, for other fish species, and for ecosystem processes. They made recommendations for the salmon to focus on population growth rates and to use the doubling goal as sort of a aspirational goal, but to really think about how do we change the dynamics so that the salmon population begins to increase on a consistent manner. For the fish populations, they recommended looking at a community of fish species. And so not looking at individual species, but looking at how is the fish community responding, both native species as well as non-native species. And then the ecosystem processes, they emphasized focusing on primary productivity and sort of the base of the food web. Linking those to flows, you know, their recommendations were around the biological responses to flows, but clearly the concept of using flows effectively, pulse flows and otherwise, was what they were thinking about. And I think it is true there that the board's recommendations, I think, were very strong in terms of those, the flow requirements, the specifics around how you would use those in a seasonal patterns is still to be worked out, but I think that is clearly being recognized.
Thanks.
Hi, Alf Brandt with the California State Assembly Speaker's Office. And I want to thank you. I want to start with thank you because I'm impressed with the collaboration you're leading, the breadth of the report. It's beyond just the narrow issues. I mean, 10 years ago, we created the council and we created the science program partly to deal with this, because the practice was each agency did science that they needed to support their project. And it was just a narrow piece. So I really appreciate the work that's been done here and the leadership that you're doing. And the last piece is the questions you're asking. Supervisor Villegas, right on point about what do we do with this? And I think we didn't necessarily set out, and you do this with the science necessarily, but we gave you a number of authorities. I think that's in some ways the next step, perhaps, is thinking about what the council does with this science and how it might use it and lead with this in its unique role of being independent and not having, you know, some authorities like regulatory authorities, but how can you feed in? How can you do that? So I would suggest considering a couple of ways of thinking about this. One is your role in coordination with all the agencies that are doing this, and how does this feed into it? How does it feed into their thinking about it? Your questions about floodplain inundation, what does that mean for the Flood Protection Board if they're focused on just flood protection, and that is it means stop it, you know, just don't do it. How does that help? How does the science help them think about even their mission and what they're doing and how they're managing the levees in the Delta, the levees that are the state federal levees? How is it, you know, you talk about land use, which is great, which is one of the things that was, you know, among water people, it was thinking, we're not involved, you know, but it's great to think about those kinds of wetlands. And what does that mean for the counties? What does it mean for Yolo County or for Solano County that has the Sassoon Marsh? What does it mean for land management and for land use regulations and thinking about that? I think of the projects on Sherman and Twitchell Island. Those are important issues, and maybe you can think about how you help the counties think about the role that they play in the larger Delta activities. And then I think OSHA brought up some good points about thinking about feeding into how does this feed into the voluntary agreements? What does it suggest for the things that the administration should be looking for out of the things that they're seeking from those, and I think that's helpful. So I would encourage. So thank you. I think this is great. I mean, this is a time. I mean, it's been a decade now. So where, you know, I think you have an important role here, and I think you continue to have an important role. And I think some suggest, oh well, you know, is it important? You know, anymore, is the council important? I think you're critical. I think this kind of role. But there are a number of things you can do, you can play, you can contribute to the progress on thinking about the Delta broadly that goes beyond the ability or the what we call the agencies that are DWR, the state board, to do. You bring it all together, and that's what's critical. So thank you, and I encourage you to keep going, and let me know how I can help.
I just want to make a comment on everything that you said. We have had a retreat, I don't know, like 2 months ago, or three, and that's one of the very critical subjects that we discussed, that we do have a lot of science in how do we translate that into policy and how do we help the legislators or everybody else that creates these policies so that we can make a difference, so we can have an impact. So, and I think building consensus among agencies has been one of them, and coming up with, and we even talked about there is a point that you bring crisis to an issue, and I don't know if everybody agrees here, but it's important to, when we know scientifically there are certain findings, how do we bring crisis to it, and how do we make it, put it on the map, and how do we work towards making it an agenda item around which people come together and move an agenda?
I think those are some good questions. I'd say, you know, with the legislature, we're used to responding to crisis. 10 years ago, there was a crisis in the Delta, and we do this. Very well, but we often are not able to gather, you know, 80 members' attention for an extended time unless there's something like that. But I think you have the opportunity to talk about some of these things and bring it to. And I think Supervisor Villegas, you know, your role among Delta counties can be helpful to bringing this and identifying these kinds of issues and making. I don't know whether it's making a crisis, but bringing attention to the emerging issues and some of the emerging standards that they talked about. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, I think that's an opportunity for you. Mm-hmm. I don't have the answer exactly how, but I think that there's ways. And I think you are in a uniquely positioned, being independent and being crossover among all the different things going on in the Delta. Mm-hmm. I think you may be able to help identify that. Maybe that's the challenge you've got in front of you.
It is a challenge. And we kind of like even exaggerated it and we said, like, how do we make CNN talk about the smelt?
Right.
And really bring attention to, or whatever we think that our scientific findings are, that are a lot here right now.
Right.
So.
Well, and there are things that are getting attention, you know, the voluntary agreements to some extent, all those kinds of things. How do you play in? How do you play off those kinds of things that are getting the attention? I mean, you're right. I mean, I got to say, during the drought period in 2014, we were able to do some big things and dig Sigma in 2014, partly because there was a crisis. And one of the things I point to is 42 days in a row on the front page of the New York Times, 42 days in a row. There was something, even little stuff, about California and water and drought and all those kinds of things and the unsafe drinking water and the woman who didn't have water coming out of her tap in East Porterville, you know, those kinds of things. But look for those opportunities where there are things on the paper. Look at what's showing up in the paper or on, I don't know whether CNN will get it, Stockton's channel, all those kinds of things. Look what's there and say, how does this tie in? How can we tie in to the things that are getting the attention? And wish you well.
Let me know if I can help. The same page. Yeah.
Thank you, Alf. Thank you very much. Thanks for the encouragement and the gratitude and encouraging us to convey the urgency with our science. John?
Any other questions for Caitlin?
Very helpful.
Thank you, Caitlin. Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. Thank you for coming
all the way
up here. And yes, thank you, Letitia, and also I want to acknowledge Martina Kohler's role from our staff. She was on the steering committee for the estuary report and really provided a lot of input. So, okay. So I want to now shift to the article that I included for this month's review, and it's directly related to what we have been talking about already. I chose it specifically because we're in the midst of thinking about the ecosystem amendment, and it's extremely relevant to all of the ecosystem amendment issues that we have been talking about. So the title of the paper is Linkages Between Flow Regime, Biota, and Ecosystem Processes, Implications for River Restoration. It's by Margaret Palmer and Albert Ruhi. Margaret Palmer is the director of a National Institute on Ecosystem Social Science Issues that was started by the National Science Foundation about 5 years ago. It's back in Annapolis, Maryland, called SASINC. And Margaret Palmer, she's a very, very well-respected river restoration ecologist. Albert Ruhi is a relatively young, new scientist who's working at UC Berkeley. He actually presented recently to the Delta Independent Science Board. He participated in our Ecosystem Thresholds report, and he's doing a lot of really interesting work through the work that SASINC really, this center in Annapolis, really promotes science synthesis around ecological and social issues. And so this collaboration was published in Science Magazine the most prestigious journal in the country for science. So I'd say that in itself is really important, to that science, if you look at science's articles, most of them are molecular. You know, they're very few ecological articles that are published. They published a 13-page review on ecosystem restoration, on river restoration, that really highlights the importance of this issue. The key concepts that they really promote in this paper are there in the title, connecting up flows, biota or organisms, and ecosystem processes, and how all three of those fit together. And it's directly related to this idea of beneficial floods or floodplain inundation. And so what they wanted to do was really call to everyone's attention the connections between these issues, and that floods directly affect organisms by transporting them, by creating the physical conditions in the river, temperature, water quality, depth, all kinds of physical conditions, by moving the organisms around, indirectly by affecting competitors, predators, food webs. So there's all those linkages between flows and organisms. And then for the ecosystem processes, they're talking about the things that the Biological Goals Report was talking about as well. Primary productivity, the role of decomposition in making nutrients reavailable within the ecosystem, and how flow brings in that organic matter and the nutrients to the system and then affects the chemical and physical conditions that allow for organic matter to accumulate or for decomposition to take place. And then all of those together affect the food web across the ecosystem. And so they highlight all of those linkages, and then they identify how we can use some of those insights to improve the way we do restoration. And really, exactly what they talk about is what is in the ecosystem amendment. The idea of using process-based restoration is introduced and really an emphasis in the paper, as well as the key component of the ecosystem amendment. So I think it's really a really nice overview, a valuable synthesis, highlights the importance of synthesis, bringing together our understanding. And those are the key things I wanted to highlight with that article. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Ken.
Yeah, John, does the findings in the article kind of support our emphasis on land-water connection? Is that something?
Absolutely. So I mean, to me, that is the key point that they're making, is that connectivity issues, the inundation mm-hmm. issues is what's most critical, and connecting flow to habitat is what those linkages are all about.
So this is sort of, you know, if there's one headline out of the ecosystem amendment, is really that land-water connection and supported, that's at the heart of the ecosystem function. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yes, I would say that's what will drive productivity. That's what, you know, we've heard about the Yolo Bypass example as all those benefits that move through the food web that we're really trying to achieve. So it's the linkage between that, the flow and the adjacent habitats.
Sounds good. Sounds like something everybody can understand.
Yeah. And I'd say this would have been probably central, a key paper that would be cited in the ecosystem chapter, except that it came out just in September. So, mm-hmm. And I'm sure it will be, you know, a really critical paper over the next 5 years or so. Driving, one thing they do is highlight a lot of the, in addition to what we currently know, what many of the uncertainties are and where we should focus research moving down the road. And some of the things that we have all talked about here in terms of interactions between factors. And ISB, I know, was asked to look at, you know, what different factors affecting fish populations, and they highlight it's not one, it's, you know, it's multiple factors and interactions amongst those factors that are critical. So I think it's very, very useful. Any other questions?
Can you provide us with a link to the report?
Yes.
Great, thank
you. I'll just send you a copy of the paper. And there's actually a Science is also now including one-page summaries for some of their key articles that just do a briefer overview that is also very valuable.
Send that too.
I'll send them both. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so then I'll be brief on the other topic. So I wanted to highlight some recent conferences and workshops, some of which I've already mentioned to you. So the Thresholds and Restorations Symposium, I mentioned last month that we had just had it, and I think it was really valuable. Highlights a lot of the same concepts. Actually, Albert Ruhi, who is the author of this, presented there and presented one of the really interesting things he presented, and something that's in this article is about the use of new technologies and broader not just data collection, but data synthesis with large, large data sets as we're, you know, we have continuous data on water quality. So he did a really interesting study on an Arizona river system looking at the relative effects of flow and non-native species on native fish in this relatively arid Arizona river system. And using some really sophisticated analyses, he showed that the native fish population is much more strongly correlated with variability in flow than it is with impacts of non-native species. Mm-hmm. Using their analysis, it was 80% of the variability in the native fish population was much more strongly connected to the variation in flow in the river.
Like they were more resistant than the non-native.
Yes, and have the non-natives didn't have as strong of an impact on the native fish as the flow did. So the native fish population was much more strongly connected to flow variability than to any negative effects of invasive fish species, which that's for that particular system. And I know there's lots of debate here about what's the relative effect of flow and other issues. I think what was valuable about what Albert did was just some of the new analysis techniques that he's using, where he can give some insight on that I think would be useful to adopt in some of the approaches that are being used
here. The flow is more impactful
exactly.
than the non-native.
Okay. Exactly, yes. So that threshold symposium, I think, was really a valuable one. There will be a summary, a synthesis of that will be put together. Probably takes maybe 6 months or so for that to be put together, and then I'll update you when that's available. I also mentioned the Coastal and Estuarine Research Federation conference that was held in early November, and Madison, one of our Sea Grant fellows, presented at that and presented on zooplankton issues and putting together a database for zooplankton across the estuary and across the delta. In addition, she also participated in the zooplankton identification workshop that I think was something that was put together by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, but that we participated in. Both Madison and Sam Bashevkin attended, and Karen Kafitz also helped coordinate that, just highlighting the importance of proper identification for those difficult-to-identify species that are an important part of the food web within the estuary. So those are all the recent conferences I wanted to highlight. In terms of two things to mention in terms of upcoming events, there is a symposium, another joint symposium with UC Davis on environmental DNA at the end of January, January 29th, that is now available for registration and should be a really valuable symposium. And then I also mentioned the draft report for the Social Science Task Force should be out either later today or tomorrow, and when it's out, I'll send a link of that to you. And I'll give you more detail on that next month. Comments are available for the public until the end of January on the Social Science Task Force report. And then I also did want to highlight that the By the Numbers report is there for you. It has a new look. I would encourage you to look it over. It's much more visual and hopefully easier for you to understand. Reservoir levels are high to very high. We're still slightly below average for overall precipitation, but reasonably high. Temperatures are relatively similar. In terms of salinity and flows and salinity, things are also pretty close to normal, although San Joaquin's much higher, some releases on the San Joaquin. And the salinity levels on the San Joaquin were relatively high, but similar to last year, where there's agricultural runoff coming in with some higher salt concentrations. So any questions? And I want to acknowledge Kate Mallinson's work on this, putting together a really nice update to the by the numbers. Okay, I'm finished then.
Thank you, John. Yeah, I am really pleased at how visual our data communications are becoming. Very understandable.
Good. Madam Chair, can I ask a question just on that? Because I'm assuming, John, the reason behind the red in the San Joaquin River at Bernalis under the salinity is highlighted in red is for a reason, because all the others are in a different color.
Yeah, it's above average.
Okay, so that just indicates above average.
Yeah.
And so
compared to running averages from previous years.
I see. Okay. So is that so very far? Is that how do I compare?
So the green, the dark green is close to average, then blue is slightly out of whack. Mm-hmm. Orange farther away from the average, and red significantly away from the average.
Got it. Okay.
So it's moderately high, but probably not. I wouldn't think anything. You know, not.
We're not writing home to mom about it yet.
No. Okay. I think it's a similar to last year. We had a short term pulse, and by February it was back to normal.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, John. My button is being finicky. On to agenda item 9, Delta Conveyance Update.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to invite Carrie Buckman to come forward. Carrie's from the Department of Water Resources and wanted to provide us with an update on the schedule for release of environmental documents related to water conveyance infrastructure in the Delta. So thank you, Carrie.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here, Carrie. Good to finally meet you in person.
Nice to be here. And we're really early in the process, but I'll say this now and later. Anytime you want updates, I'm happy to come in, so just let us know. So today, because we are still early in the process, I was planning to give a brief update on the status, our next steps, and then also I had heard some questions about the role of the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority, or the DCA, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about roles and responsibilities as well. So just to recap some of the history, which I think you all know, but I understand we haven't been here for an update since all of this change. So, in 2006, DWR started the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which shifted to California Water Fix in 2015 and was approved under CEQA in 2017, and then came for a consistency determination. But in earlier 2019, the governor's State of the State declared a lack of support for California Water Fix as defined and introduced a new approach to modernize Delta conveyance with a single tunnel alternative. And then in Executive Order N-19, he directed agencies to recommend a suite of priorities and actions to build a climate-resilient water system and ensure healthy waterways, including assessment and consideration of a single tunnel conveyance system. At that point, DWR withdrew the project approvals and rescinded the permits and permit applications for Water Fix, and all California Water Fix planning ceased. That project is no more, and since then we've been working to sort of turn the direction of the ship, which is a fairly substantial effort.
The name is the new name?
The Delta Conveyance Project.
Thank you.
So for the proposed Delta Conveyance Project, moving forward, we are planning to release a Notice of Preparation, or NOP, to start the process. We're planning to do that soon to document our intent to develop an Environmental Impact Report, or EIR, for the proposed Delta Conveyance Project. The NOP will trigger the start of scoping, and that will allow us to receive input on the scope and content of the EIR. It will also establish the public comment period and identify the public comment meetings where we will seek public comments on the scope. So in the NOP, we will include a description of the proposed project objectives and a description of the proposed project. And the description is really just a starting point so that the public can understand the type of project we're looking at and comment on the scope of the environmental analysis and a range of reasonable alternatives. I know that sometimes there's confusion that the NOP includes a proposed project and that represents a decision of some sort, but it does not. This is the starting point. A decision is made at the end. It's just giving people an idea about what the project is so they have a way to comment. So I have a schedule, and I didn't have them in advance, so I'm not sure if I can hand out handouts. Is that okay?
Is there a chance
we
can
have plenty
ask questions,
of copies,
though?
So I have two handouts that we can. One of them is a general.
Carrie,
one.
Do you
want to take them?
I'd rather go as, have them as we okay. go. Yeah.
I just was going to ask you because you had a very good point. You said, you know, the purpose and description of the project is not what it is now, but we will come to understand what it is down the line when mm-hmm. we do the research. But yet, the description of the project is already done, and we know it is one tunnel. So could you just shed some light on that?
So CEQA requires a notice of preparation to include a proposed project, and the reason is that it's hard for people to comment on nothing, right? Like if you don't have any idea about what the project is, it's very hard to figure out how to make comments on the scope of the environmental analysis mm-hmm. and alternatives. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's very general. We don't have all of the details on the proposed project yet. It's a very general project description that we will continue to flesh out. And we're also looking for alternatives and feedback from the public about what those alternatives should be that we will consider when identifying.
I am familiar to the CEQA process and the alternatives mm-hmm. that are going to be developing, but how much of the purpose of the project is clear now? Like, for example, let's say if we end up with one strong alternative that says very targeted approaches and treatments and very targeted smaller projects that, you know, in its totality, it's going to do what our purpose of this project is, that can come out from the process as one of the alternatives.
So we expect we'll get a lot of comments on the alternatives during the scoping process, and that will lead to an alternatives formulation document where we examine the potential to reduce environmental effects and how well the alternatives meet the project objectives, and then identify a reasonable range of alternatives.
So you would say that the most overriding goal could be said that it is pretty much still defined how much water should be left and how much. What is the most general level of goal from this project that you would say today we can say?
I mean, I think that what we've been saying is to modernize Delta conveyance. That was the governor's direction.
Okay, modernize the Delta conveyance. Yeah. Thank you.
So I handed out a very general schedule of key milestones. And so it's as I said, very general, particularly when we get to the bottom where we have water rights, Delta plan consistency, and other permits. But we're working to flesh this out. A couple of things to note. We're starting CEQA with a notice of preparation. And we're planning to have a draft EIR available for review at the beginning of 2021. You'll see the public review period there. And a final EIR in early 2022. We will be concurrently working on compliance with the Endangered Species Act and the California Endangered Species Act. And then we have starting in about middle 2021 efforts on water rights, Delta plan consistency, and other environmental permits. I do want to highlight that we're not saying we won't start anything until then. That's sort of when the intensive period of development for those efforts will start, but we're planning to start early consultation for that as soon as we have a project. And the environmental efforts will build on the work done to date where it is applicable and still available to be used and appropriate. So moving on to the other handout that I handed out, this is on the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority, or the DCA. So the DCA was established as a joint power authority between the participating water agencies to help with the design and construction of the California Water Fix project. It has a board of directors that are composed of elected board members from participating public water agencies. It was developed to have up to 7 members, but right now it has 4. 2 of them are depending on the participation of federal agencies, and the other is waiting for some of the changes in project description to really get shaken out. So it may have between 4 and 7 moving forward. Mm. So the DCA has a joint exercise of powers agreement with DWR, and that was changed to go from the design for California Water Fix to the environmental planning phase of the new Delta Conveyance project. So right now it is the DCA's purpose is to provide design as part of the environmental planning and permitting process, and that is work under DWR's direction and oversight. So we have asked the DCA to develop preliminary designs for a proposed project and alternatives when we have them developed, and that will serve as the basis for analysis in the EIR. And we would like these designs to consider options to avoid and minimize construction-related effects where possible, so they are building some of those measures in up front. So looking at the figure that I gave you, this helps provide some information about the roles and responsibilities of each group. So starting with DWR, DWR is the owner and operator of the State Water Project, so we are the lead agency under CEQA, and this is our responsibility. So under the authority of the California Natural Resources Agency, we will lead the environmental review and planning effort. We will lead public outreach, public participation, and stakeholder engagement. We will ensure transparency. We will be responsible for managing the budget and schedule. We will report on progress to the state legislature and others, and we will direct and oversee the work of DCA. DCA's role is that under the oversight of DWR, the DCA will conduct engineering and design work to inform the environmental review and planning process, identify potential engineering and design strategies to avoid or minimize effects, and direct and assist in conducting public outreach, public participation, and stakeholder engagement activities. And we also did want to talk a little bit about the public water agencies as the beneficiaries and eventual they will be funding whatever project comes out of this. They have a role as well. So they will both inform DCA and DWR with public or with technical resources, but they also are part of the DCA Board of Directors and have some fiduciary responsibility as such. So one of the key things that's been happening with the DCA now that I think has probably come to the attention of some of the council is that they have started a stakeholder engagement committee. And so the Stakeholder Engagement Committee was formed by the DCA's board to help identify ways to design and construct the project that would avoid or minimize effects to the local communities and the Delta as a place. The Stakeholder Engagement Committee has 17 members that were selected to represent key stakeholders in the Delta and 5 ex officio members to help provide information to the committee. The committee members had to submit an application to be on the committee, and one of the things that it included is how they were planning to reach back out to the people that they're representing to make sure that they're sharing information and receiving feedback so their participation is not simply representing their own views but also the views of the groups that they represent. The members do not need to agree that the Delta Conveyance Project should move forward. In fact, most of the group opposes the project. This is a committee to the DCA board, and as a committee, the topics are limited to work being completed by the DCA, which again is helping develop design and conceptual designs for the proposed project and alternatives in a way that minimizes or avoids effects to local communities. So that is the focus of the SEC.
Can I ask you to give us a sense of the makeup of the Stakeholder Engagement Committee?
Sure. So there are 17 members. They represent a wide spectrum of interests. So there are 5 members from each of the 5 counties that were selected. And then there's a recreation representative, environmental justice, agriculture, a water district that provides water within the Delta. I'm not going to be able to rattle off all of them, but I'm sorry? A number of them are representing NGOs, yes. Okay. There is a terrestrial representative. There is a tribal representative that has an alternate so that we make sure we have a tribal representative available.
Maria. I had asked her to give us a sense of the makeup of the Stakeholder Engagement Committee.
Which is not on this chart.
It is not. That is the committee that feeds to the DCA board. They provide input to the board. They did. So they asked for applications. I think they were due at the beginning of December. The first meeting was in December, at the beginning of November. First meeting was in November, and the second meeting was last week. So there's definitely a little bit of a challenge to understand the SEC's role in terms of their participation with the DCA and their participation in commenting on CEQA. We wanted to be clear that committee is not the right forum to comment on the CEQA documentation and the CEQA process. DWR will be leading that effort, so DWR will have a separate public engagement effort that we will do as part of the scoping, or as part of the CEQA process that includes scoping and public meetings and also other workshops. So this does not take the place of that public involvement. There will be a separate forum for that involvement. So this is focused on ways to reduce effects and changes that can be made to the designs to make them more sensitive to the local communities. So the SEC, they call it the SEC for short, which we all find a little confusing, but it's starting to seep into my mind. So sorry, that stands for Stakeholder Engagement Committee. So it's scheduled to meet once or twice a month. Two meetings have occurred, and the next meeting is scheduled for January 22nd, and then they'll start two meetings in February and two meetings in March. And it is a Brown Act body. All materials are posted on the DCA's website. So any other questions about the DCA or the Stakeholder Engagement Committee?
Yeah, since you asked, I wasn't going to ask that question, but so the SEC, the Stakeholder Engagement Committee, I know in part was created as a result of a feeling that there needed to be more stakeholder engagement, right, in this next iteration. So is there a way in which the DCA or DWR, under its purview, is going to measure whether or not there's been value added by a stakeholder engagement committee? Because I've seen just the first meeting, I think, or maybe the first or second meeting minutes that reflect some of the conversations, really good questions, some of which maybe have been considered, others maybe not. So I'm curious, is there going to be some way to measure whether or not there's value? Because there's a lot of people, a lot of very knowledgeable people showing up to these meetings to provide input. So I'm just curious if that's
We haven't yet established a set of metrics. At the end of both meetings so far, the participants have thanked the group and indicated that they thought that the material was useful. Again, that is not indicating any level of agreement with things, but more a level of I'd say satisfaction that material is being shared and transparent. Any other questions? Okay, so one last topic on my list is that as part of the Delta Conveyance effort, we did release a soil investigation initial study and proposed mitigated negative declaration. The project is to conduct soil investigations throughout the Delta. It includes potentially some soil borings on land or over water, cone penetration tests, and geophysical surveys. So it's out now for public review, and the public review has been extended through January 15th of 2020. And the purpose of the project is to gather data to inform and evaluate alternatives for the Delta Conveyance Project and also to provide geotechnical information to other efforts going on within the Delta. So I think that's all of the material I had for today. I did want to, again, thank you all for having me. And if I can come back at any time, I'm really looking forward to collaborating with the DSC over the next few years of this project.
Thank you, Carrie. Randy?
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for coming. A year ago, prior to the withdrawal of the certification of consistency for WaterFix, we conducted an appeals hearing in October, and we had a workshop in November. At the November workshop, there was a 150-some-odd-page report responding to the findings from the October hearing in regards to the appeals. How has that document influenced or contributed to the planning that you have underway now?
So I probably should have started with a brief introduction about myself. So my role in the project is the Environmental Program Manager, and I started in mid-July. And one of the main things that is my purpose is to try to figure out ways to integrate all of the processes on the environmental side. So rather than saying CEQA is starting now, and so that's what we're going to focus on, thinking forward and trying to identify things that we can do now that will help in an eventual consistency process to make sure that we are as consistent as we can be with the project right now, rather than waiting until later and saying, oh, we should have done that. So I will say that what we've been doing is trying to identify ways that we can consider some of the Delta Plan elements and what we're planning at the beginning rather than waiting until later.
That's great news.
Have you begun to engage Stewardship Council staff in early consultation?
Well, we don't have a project yet, so we haven't started early consultation, but we have started talking to the staff members so that we are setting up how we might work together eventually.
But it occurs to me that during the workshop last November, one of the reasons for an inadequate record was that the project proponent ran out of time. And so there were things known then about conforming to the Delta plan that it would seem to me could be worked on right now, irregardless of what the ultimate project is. So I would encourage you to engage the Stewardship Council staff and seek as much help as can be provided to assist.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. The other thing is, on the timeline, I think I've received clarification through other channels, but to come to the Stewardship Council requires, for consistency, a final project. Mm-hmm. And one of the key elements, as you're aware, is the change in the point of diversion permit. So am I looking at the Delta Plan consistency and water rights, which I suspect is the change in the point of diversion?
It is.
And it seems like that process needs, well, I don't know. It just seems like they end at the same time, and one needs to precede.
We are working on a more detailed Microsoft project schedule that shows some of those linkages. This is a very broad overview.
No, it's good.
I should have been more specific about that up front. But yes, we do understand that that's an important element.
Yeah, the last time around was a painful process. And I just want to make sure that lessons learned are applied as early as possible.
Thank you.
But thank you for coming, and you've got a big job, and
yes.
Best wishes.
Thanks.
Is there any public comment on this agenda item? No public comment. Well, in that case, thank you again,
okay.
Carrie.
Thank you.
On to agenda item 10, Delta Plan Performance Measures 2019 Year in Review.
Thanks. Let's have Jeff Henderson and Martina Kohler from the Council's Planning Division come up. And I just wanted to say that this report is really linked in a lot of ways to the report that Caitlin gave earlier at the Council meeting. And I think, the indicators are really important tools for management and for science research overall. And so, really welcome Jeff and Martina to talk about the Delta Plan performance measures and really sort of the fine-grained detail that these provide in reference to the Delta Plan and our policies and our recommendations. And this is sort of one of the first really annual reports that they are doing, and they've made a lot of progress over the last year in terms of transparency and reporting and reaching out to stakeholders.
Okay. Thank you, Jessica. Good afternoon, everyone. So Martina and I are going to give you a short presentation, and we're going to highlight some key things about our performance measures. As Jessica mentions, our performance measures are really tied to our plan. And so these are measures regarding how well the Delta plan is achieving its objectives. They're fairly detailed. They're fairly fine-grained. They rely on a lot of primary data collected from different state and federal agencies with regard to performance of different parts of the Delta system. And so in some ways they're related to and consistent with the types of measures that you heard about this morning that I might characterize a bit more as indicators, whereas these measures are indicators, but they're also measures of how well is the strategy that you've laid out in the Delta plan working. I think that's a one way to kind of distinguish the types of measures we discussed a bit earlier from the types of measures we'll be presenting now. So we'll give a short background on why we feel the performance measures underlying the Delta Plan are important. We'll talk a bit about the dashboard that Jessica Pearson alluded to earlier and how it's been used since it was publicly launched earlier this year. We'll talk about an addition to that dashboard that we've made that adds what we refer to as administrative performance measures, which are really the descriptors for how individual agencies have taken action on Delta Plan recommendations And then we'll conclude by discussing some of our plans for 2020, which will be further detailed in a work plan to be presented to the council, but we'll share with you some of the initial thoughts that we've had regarding activities to focus on with regard to performance measures in the new year. So by way of background, the Delta Plan performance measures are exactly that, measurable. These are indicators that the council adopted as part of the Delta Plan in order to measure how progress toward the goals and objectives of the plan is moving forward. These are time-based and they're measurable, and that's meant to be so that they can be compared across different time frames and measured for specific on-the-ground conditions that reflect the management actions and the target outcomes that are outlined in the Delta Plan. And they're based on the core strategies, the policies, and the recommendations themselves that are presented in the Delta Plan. In many cases where you have a Delta Plan recommendation, you would also have an administrative measure that talks about what the agency charged with the action is meant to do and by when, as well as potential output and outcome measures that describe the result. So they're the three different types of those measures. The measures are important because they provide information about, again, how well the Delta Plan's working, particularly with regard to kind of itemizing the strategies, the policies, and the recommendations. And after more years pass and we have additional data, we're going to be able to begin to see the impacts of those decisions. So this is a way of tracking the impact of the decisions made by the council with regard to how to proceed with the Delta Plan objectives. And then we'll be assessing the status and trends toward measurable targets. The insights that we gain will help us determine if the Delta Plan is progressing in the manner that we had established it upon adoption and amendment, and what adjustments in the management approach may need to be made. This is a means of adaptive management. And, you know, as the council will recall, there's a commitment in the Delta Plan to adaptively manage the plan itself. And the performance measures are really the way that we measure our progress to identify if changes are warranted or needed. And that's part of the vision of the performance measures. And then lastly, we're doing it, well, because we have to. The Delta Reform Act requires the adoption of these performance measures. So this is something that goes back to the statute itself. Our reporting provides a number of advantages. The performance measures communicate our annual progress in implementing recommended actions by the agencies. And I want to really stress the word annual. It is our intent in the planning division to establish an annual program. During what part of the year is the team focused on what aspects of performance measure, tracking, development, potential amendment, and at what points in the year are there interfaces with the council with regard to the performance of those measures? So this provides us some annual updates of progress both of the council and of other agencies in implementing the Delta Plan. The performance measures evaluate the status of output and outcome measures based on source data analysis and synthesis. So this is a process the staff engages in to collect data from other agencies in order to report that progress to you. We use our dashboard, the new dashboard that's been created, to communicate the information that supports the performance measures. And this provides information for our five-year reviews and, again, the adaptive management of the Delta Plan itself. We really view future five-year review cycles as a time frame to really sort of pause and take stock of what the performance measures have been showing us, and at that point present to the council options for potential updates or changes to the Delta Plan that may be warranted by the trends and data that the performance measures show. So it's meant to be a means of really a deliberative means to assess when and if the Delta Plan should be updated as well. Just a quick reminder as we discuss the performance measures that there are three types. Administrative measures, which we alluded to earlier, talk about the actions, decisions, policies, planning projects, funding awards, and other types of resource actions that individual agencies take to implement the Delta Plan. We have output measures, which track on-the-ground implementation of those actions. And we have outcome measures that then look at the physical response of the system to that change. So there's three different layers of measures that kind of progress from the activity, the activity in terms of a decision or a policy or a funding, the activity in terms of a change on the ground, and then the effect of that change on the ground is a good way to think about those. So I'll turn it over to Martina, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the updates that have been made to the dashboard, as well as some activities that were completed this year.
Good afternoon, council members and Chair Tetayan. So a main mean of communicating the performance measures is the dashboard, as has been mentioned. The dashboard has been launched in April of this year. So now it's about 8 months later. We can say that the dashboard has been an effective and important tool how council communicates the performance measures. The dashboard provides interactive visualizations of performance baselines, metrics, and targets. It has a user-friendly and intuitive design intended to reach a broad audience and provide a breadth of technical details and multiple layers of technical information and context information about each measure. A summary of users' access and page views tells us that during the 6 months period, the dashboard reached over 7,600 page views. The dashboard is averaging about 1,000 page views monthly. So we have a somewhat consistent user base of about 300 users monthly who regularly access the dashboard. Maybe a short story about the dashboard nationwide reach. We had someone contacted us from the Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago in Illinois who wanted to learn about how we developed the performance measures reporting as a project and how we designed and built the dashboard. And also closer to home, we've shared our lessons learned from the performance tracking with the State Water Resources Control Board Performance Measures Unit. In addition to providing the performance data online, and in order to increase understanding and support for the performance measures, we also engaged in direct communication with key user groups. We conducted an outreach to partner agencies and relevant interagency work groups. The goal was to provide one-to-one interactions to educate about the performance measures in general, to demonstrate dashboard features, as well as to gather feedback on how the tool can be improved and how it can help our agency partners in their own missions. And here I would like to acknowledge the performance measures team members who were on the front lines of this outreach. Corey Copeland, Scott Navarro, and Chris Kwan are the performance measures subject matter experts. They are in the audience here, and so they can address also any questions you may have about specific measures. During the outreach, we presented at more than 20 agency meetings and interagency work groups. Agency outreach focused on program managers and decision makers that can utilize the performance dashboard. For example, we talked to DWR Executive Office, DWR Integrated Regional Water Management Office, State Water Resource Control Board, Water Master and the Division of Water Rights, Department of Fish and Wildlife Invasive Species Unit, as well as Delta Protection Commission and Delta Conservancy. We also outreach to performance data providers. And additionally, staff presented at the dashboard at several science symposia, water data summits, and technical conferences. We concluded a first phase of the outreach and learned many important lessons. To summarize the outreach, there was very positive feedback. Users praised the ease and clear navigation and functionality of the dashboard. Agency users are interested in learning more about performance measures and to continue provide feedback. They would like to be informed about key findings. Agency requested that we continue to offer this type of outreach. create a venue for providing technical input from agency subject matter experts, and also communicate our findings back to them and relevant takeaways. Many requested a dashboard to include executive summary style information. However, I think this will have to wait after we collect more data, as we established the baselines only in last year, in 2018. So initially, the dashboard included only the output and outcome measures. Later this year, in fact, just a few weeks ago, we expanded the dashboard to include also the 122 administrative measures. So with this addition, the dashboard now becomes a central access point to all Delta Plant performance measures. It now better connects between the performance measures and the associated strategies and recommendations, and between the administrative actions and the measurable output and outcomes. The dashboard also now tracks agency progress, as each recommended action has a lead agency and also many times supporting agency that implements the measure or the actions. To highlight progress during last year and a half, I would like to mention these measures that were recently completed. So the first one, designation of the Delta National Heritage Area. This is the California First National Heritage Area. The designation also brings significant resources to support Delta heritage preservation investments. Second, the State Water Resources Control Board adopted the policy for Central Valley Salinity Alternatives for Long-Term Sustainability, also known as CV salts. The policy provides options to manage salt and nitrates in the groundwater, in the Delta tributaries that also affect Delta, and allows for research prioritization and optimization to inform salt and nitrate management. Third, implementation of the nutrient study plan to inform development of objectives for nutrients for Delta and Suisun Marsh and to prioritize research actions. I'd like to mention the Delta Science Program is funding many of the components of these research studies. And the last to highlight, but not least, is the completion of site-specific objectives and the total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, for dissolved oxygen for Suisun Marsh. So these were just four highlights, but in addition, there is actually a total of 33 completed performance measures. They were completed in the last 5 years. There are 59 measures in progress and that are on schedule. 18 are in progress, but behind schedule. And there are 12 measures that are out of alignment with council objectives due to the Delta Plan amendments or with other agencies' objectives. And all this has been summarized in the recently completed 5-year review report. So I would like to turn back to Jeff to kind of outline and mention what are our plans for the upcoming year.
Okay, and before I go on, I just wanted to highlight these four measures are ones that were completed in 2018 or 2019. So as Martina mentioned, since the Delta Plan's adoption, since we first came up with these administrative measures, 33 total have been completed. What we're doing here is highlighting for you four key ones that sort of are benchmark achievements for the last 2 years. And that's something I think, as you know, our hope is to be able to come to you each December, look back on the previous year, and start to check things off the list in terms of thinking about the Delta Plan recommendations as a list of accomplishments that are necessary to achieve the co-equal goals. Here are four that were met last year. So I think that's sort of the takeaway that we want to be able to have from this type of a summary. So looking ahead to 2020, we've got a number of next steps in mind for, again, ways to sort of more annualize the process of collecting data about performance measures, identifying potential trends that would be of interest to the council from a policy perspective. So I think this touches that question of, if we have the information, great, what do we do with it? And I think that's one of the things we're trying to use these performance measures for, is to be able to provide a data-driven, scientifically supported reason for the council to potentially take action. So I think that's another key aspect of these measures. So we're looking to develop an annual protocol to figure out, and we do a lot of these things now. This is simply a means of sort of putting a package to it. How we process the data, how we evaluate the performance measure performance, how we report on it to stakeholders, the community at large, and importantly to the council, and what that means. We're also planning to expand the outreach to target additional audiences and provide multiple opportunities to engage and to share information. This may include the idea of organizing a focused workshop to be able to reach multiple audiences at an event. To build on our existing agency interactions, we're looking at means to expand measure-specific interactions. So what we do right now is we reach out to agencies or like divisions within agencies or units within agencies that share multiple measures. This focus would be, you know, there may be a handful of measures that we really want to focus on next year. Let's really emphasize the outreach to the folks responsible for those measures to develop a better understanding. And I think that really ties to any potential areas where the council may wish to focus or take specific action. To enhance communication of technical and management relevant details, we'll be leveraging existing opportunities. This ties to, I think, the council's communications goals about using our existing digital communications means, using council meetings, using DPIC meetings, and interacting with other technical work groups to get the message out there about these measures and their importance. And then in closing, the set of PMs, or performance measures, that the council has adopted will continue to provide assessments and improve understanding, again, of how the Delta plan is working. So, again, it's this means of checking off the activities that have been completed, looking ahead to ones that can need to continue focus, and working through this on an annual basis. That, I think, concludes our presentation. We're happy to respond to any questions.
Are there any questions, Councilor Maria?
Going back to the page that has the performance measures, and there's like kind of like the dashboard, the six, and you know, on a large title scale of Delta as an evolving place and protect people and property, they're kind of like two different things. However, the subcategories of them can intertwine, right? For example, multi-hazard coordination task force could be both in protect the people and could be Delta as an evolving place.
This diagram, actually, this is a really good spot to stop. This diagram is sort of the landing page, if you will, for the measures. It's organized water supply, Delta ecosystem, Delta's evolving place, water quality, protect people and property. Those are organized according to Delta plan chapter. So then each of the measures, so if you look under the list for water supply, these are all performance measures that are associated with policies or recommendations in that chapter. You're correct. There are interplay between these. Many of the measures speak to multiple objectives. But
especially those two.
Exactly. And then just in terms of organization, that's how we've aligned them just so that they match Delta Plan chapter structure.
Randy.
I know that a lot of the information on the website was taken down because it needed to be ADA compliant. Is the dashboard ADA compliant?
I am happy to report that the dashboard is ADA
compliant. Okay. Congratulations.
We were lucky at the beginning, actually. We had it as a part of the requirement when we built the dashboard. So
very
that was
smart.
An easy.
Good job. Thanks.
Really smart.
Yep. I would also encourage one of the other things I think people find the dashboard useful for is to understand the scope and breadth of the Delta plan. In the sense of, I mean, it's important to read the chapters and to understand the content of all of the policies and recommendations. Using this website is a good way to get a sense of, do we affect that? And just kind of looking at the different topics and how the discussions under those topics are arranged. So it's not in any way a substitute for the Delta plan, but it is a good way to get kind of a conceptual picture of the range of topics that the council affects in one sitting.
Oscar.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick comment. Thank you very much for the presentation. Very helpful. As we've been talking, I've been going through the website. It is very user-friendly, even with my old phone that my kids have given me when they get the newer upgrade. So I always worry that I'm going to be able to use it. And even my old phone, it works really well. So I guess the only thing I would add is to Maria's comment about how it's structured to mirror the Delta plan. I think, and I didn't see that in here, but it's something that you might consider in the future, is just actually stating that as people are reading it. Because it flows really well, but to think that it actually mirrors the Delta plan, I think gives it more status or more stature in whatever form. And then the other thing that I always am curious about when I see these kinds of dashboards is, when is the next data dump going to occur? And I'm sure you've given that some thought as well, but it's always something that if I go back to it 6 months from now and it's the same information, I'm always curious, has somebody forgotten about it, or is it just a matter of time before there's going to be another data dump? And maybe I missed it, but I'm just offering that as a way, because I love what it provides, even the basic user who's just trying to learn about what's happening relative to the plan and its measurable objectives. So.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the comment. I think that's really important, particularly because each measure is kind of to be updated a little different time frame, and so I think it will be very helpful to have, like, okay, next update coming in January or coming in December, you know, all that. So, yes.
Thank you.
Ken.
Yeah, just a quick comment that, you know, Jeff, I think you mentioned broader communications, and it seems like being able to report progress out to some broader audience is really important. And, you know, maybe just one thing to keep in mind is, you know, it's hard every year to get a lot of performance measures. I mean, the plan is over the long haul, but there's, you know, context, those milestones along the way, like the regional board approving the basin plan amendment on DO for Sassoon Marsh. I'm sure that has sort of like a, you know, that's a milepost on the way to something else, which when we start to describe the progress we're making, it, you know, be good to have that context. And, I've been on the website, and I think I've seen some of that, but just how we say, gee, we got this. And, yeah, I know basin plan amendments are hard to get, and so that's a significant milestone, but it leads us somewhere further that we want to get to. So that's just to keep in mind as we try and communicate outside kind of the inside baseball group that we normally communicate to. And even to some of them. I mean, I think the higher level people to understand. Oh.
Thanks. I'm curious, when you reached out to the executives and middle managers, what were the kinds of questions you got? What did they focus on? The structure of the database, or the
There was I think quite a big group there. One of the comments, they focus on multiple things, like some of them is data accuracy and how are we kind of calculating the data or the source data. But the key thing that they wanted was kind of like executive level summaries, like what does that mean for us, and something that Ken is saying also, like give us snapshots, like what is it, what does it mean, like what's the overall summary. Right. So that's, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we said we will have to come back to that, right? Like, we cannot do it right now, but I think there are little things or pieces of it that we can start, you know, highlighting and providing as well. So, yes.
Uh-huh. Right. I would maybe add to that. I think that speaks to the communication value of these measures, too. I mean, I think it ties to the kind of what's next question that you have. But then it's also, you know, that's also sort of the, if we've seen a change in the data, what does that really mean? How do we craft a message around that that carries its importance and then leads us, meaning the council and others engaged in the Delta, to take action to achieve what's going on underneath that measure?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think this does tie to, you know, this desire for this executive summary level information does tie to the communications need as well.
Well, thank you. This is, I know, been a real challenge. There's an art to performance measure development as well as the science behind it, and I'm sure you got an awful lot of input
So thank you for all your hard work, you and your team. This is terrific. Are there any public comments? No. Okay. Then we'll move on to agenda item 11, any public comment in general on any item in the purview of the Delta Stewardship Council? None? All right, then our next meeting will be January 23, 2020. 2020, isn't that incredible? It will be at the Library Galleria East Meeting Room in Sacramento. So thank you all, and happy holidays.
Thank you.